Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. This is Bob McChesney coming to you today in WILL AM 580, beautiful Urbana, Illinois, our home base, based here in Campbell Hall, the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a live show for you. It's a terrific show. We're going to have as our guest Bill Fletcher Jr., one of the leaders of the U.S. labor movement of the past three or four decades, as well as one of the leaders of progressive politics in the United States, very active in journalism and media, labor, progressive politics. He'll be with us for the full hour today, talking about the state of politics today, reflecting on the American experience over the last couple decades. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, before that, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Federal Communications Commission announced it will take action against Comcast for airing video news releases on its CN8 news channel without identifying the sponsor. Video news releases, or VNRs, are public relations videos designed to look like television news stories. They are usually produced by large corporations or trade groups, and sometimes the government, to promote a product or public image. The fines against Comcast are the first issued for airing fake news and are in response to reports that uncovered specific incidents of deceptive VNR usage by broadcasters. Diane Farsetta is senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy and co-author of the reports. She explains why consumers need to know if their local TV stations are using VNRs without disclosure.
It's blatantly lying to news viewers. Television remains the number one news source in the U.S., and it's important for viewers to know that when they're being told that this new pharmaceutical is this wonder drug, that they should know that the company that makes the drug actually paid to have this spot produced. And another reason is that when you have fake news, you're not having real news.
Farsetta says that VNR usage over the past 15 years has become a massive presence within the television industry due to a confluence of factors.
One is the consolidation of station ownerships and the downsizing of television newsrooms. Another was concern of advertisers that the traditional ad spots were no longer working as well to reach their audience. And I think there was a widespread awareness among both corporations and government agencies that their message would be seen as even more authoritative if they put it into the mouths of people's local newscasters as opposed to actually saying whatever they wanted said themselves.
Farsetta estimates that over the 16 months that CMG was doing the intensive TV news monitoring, they only tracked about 2% of the total number of VNRs that were being produced by the PR industry during that time. Yet, they caught more than 100 stations.
It's fair to say that this is going on in every media market across the United States and pretty much every TV station. It's an epidemic, really, of fake news that's being put out there.
CMD and other public interest and media groups have called for simple disclosure, which means that if a TV station chooses to air a VNR, it must let the viewer know who paid for the segment. But PR firms and broadcasting groups are lobbying against disclosure rules.
It would be very hard for them to say, we want to be able to fool news viewers. So instead of saying that, they say our First Amendment rights would be damaged by the FCC telling us we need to disclose these. That's obviously a hollow argument.
VNRs make it easier for the big media companies to run their news operations with a 30 to 40% profit margin. They can spend a lot less on developing original stories. And big corporations get their products and brand out in front of news viewers who have no way of knowing they're being sold to.
So it's something that benefits pretty much everyone except for the tens of millions of Americans that tune in to local newscasts every week.
For more information on video news releases, go to prwatch.org or freepress.net/fake news.
The House of Representatives approved a bill that would protect journalists from having to reveal their confidential sources. Although 33 states and the District of Columbia already have some sort of shield laws on the books, this is the first time the House has approved federal legislation. President Bush said he would veto the bill, but the vote, 398-21, is enough to override it. The Free Flow of Information Act will cover journalists and some bloggers, those who regularly report the news and derive most of their living from their journalistic work. Under the act, Federal authorities can't compel a reporter to testify or reveal a source unless a court determines that it falls under certain categories outlined in the bill. Support was stronger than expected. Even top Republicans broke with the Bush administration to pass the bill. Sponsors of the legislation attributed the high vote to the fact that more than 40 reporters have been subpoenaed in the last 3 years. Representative Mike Pence, a Republican from Indiana and co-sponsor of the bill, said that compelling reporters to reveal the identity of confidential sources is a detriment to the public interest. Without the promise of confidentiality, he said, many important conduits of information about our government will be shut down.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host, coming to you live today for today's show on WILL AM 580. Before we get to today's guest, let me thank you, dear listeners, for the tremendous support you provided both my show, Media Matters, and WILL AM 580 last week in the pledge drive. We received 85 pledges during the broadcast via the telephone and another 10 or 15 online. Almost 100 pledgers contributing a great deal of money. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your support and how much the station needs your support. So, again, thank you. For those who didn't listen to last week's show and wish you could have made a pledge, you still can, and there will be signed copies of my book to anyone who wants to call and make the $60 pledge, WILL. So just feel free to give a call and make the pledge. We'll get a book to you. We still need your support. And again, those you have given, thank you very much. I want to now turn to today's guest, a guest I've been wanting to have on the program for actually a couple of years. Bill Fletcher Jr. Has been very active in the U.S. labor movement for the past three decades, working with the United Auto Workers, the Postal Workers, the SEIU, and finally, his last position, working as the assistant to the President, John Sweeney, of the AFL-CIO. After leaving the AFL-CIO, he went to become the president and chief executive officer of Trans-Africa Forum, a leading group working on behalf of the interests of people in the Caribbean and Africa and people of color here in the United States. Since leaving Trans-Africa Forum, he has written a book on labor and politics we'll be talking about. He is now a professor and a teacher, and he writes commonly. You can find his work on the internet or in media. He is a journalist and is a columnist. It's my pleasure to welcome Bill Fletcher Jr. to Media Matters. Bill?
Hey, I'm glad to be on the program. Thanks.
Well, it's great to have you. And just before we get started, your new book that's coming out in the spring, what's the name of it? When's it going to be out, and what's it about?
It's called Solidarity Divided. It's co-authored with my friend and longtime collaborator, Fernando Gapacin, and it's from the University of California Press, so it's due out in May or June. And basically, it's a book on the crisis of organized labor, and it's directed at regular people. It's directed at people who might be union activists, who might be active in various social movements, that are trying to make heads or tails of what's happening with organized labor and why is it in the crisis that it's in. So it's not a tell-all book. It's an analysis of the movement, but looking at some of its kind of core views and why they're so terribly flawed. And basically, we start making some proposals in the book as to what we think is necessary.
Well, I want to talk about that and go through your critique of contemporary American politics and labor.
Sure.
Throughout the show today. But, you know, the first thing I'd like to do with you, Bill, is your personal history is a very interesting story to me. I know a little bit about it. You're a friend, but I've also read a lot about you and read interviews with you. And we're roughly the same generation, so we came through more or less some similar times together.
Mm-hmm.
You went to Harvard, graduated from Harvard.
That's right.
And then rather than join what I suspect a significant percentage of your classmates did in the mid-1970s, as they did in other generations, instead of going to Wall Street or going to medical school or on to graduate school, you went directly to the shop floor.
That's right.
And became active in the labor movement. Just explain that thinking process you had in the mid-1970s, you know, when you made that decision, and what was behind your thinking, and how people around you responded to it.
Well, my father thought I was nuts. But what happened is I became interested in world events very, very young, and I actually became radicalized at the age of 13 when I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I read that and I said, wow, now I basically know what I have to do with my life. And I have to commit myself to this struggle for social justice and black freedom and all these other good things. So when I was in college, I developed an increasing interest in the black working class and in organized labor, and came to feel that unions could be much more of a vehicle than they were and than they have been in general in terms of advancing the black freedom struggle, but also that we could really start thinking about working class power in the United States. So when I got out of school, I had to decide what I was going to do, and I, like many other people of our political generation, decided that it was important to do rank-and-file organizing. And so I went to work as a welder in a shipyard. And like I said, my father thought I was nuts. My mother was fine. I mean, her point of view was sort of, you know, the kid graduated, so we should be happy, right? My father was very disappointed because he wanted me to be a lawyer, and I talked about being a lawyer. But I never regret having made that decision. I was there for about 3.5 years. It really shaped a lot of things. It was really, in many ways, my graduate education.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that I always say is that Harvard, like other Ivy League schools, trains a global ruling class. And you go in there, and you really are imbued with this notion that you are great, you are smart, and you will be ruling the world, right? Or you'll be part of that. And you really, you know, no matter what your politics are, you can become a bit arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out and I went to work as a welder, I was working with people who, in most cases, had never completed college. Some had never completed high school, yet they could do all of these things I could never conceive of doing, you know, in terms of work.
Mm-hmm.
And their skills and abilities, and I learned from them. And so it was a very, very humbling experience. I was nearly killed there in an accident, but it was what I really needed to do. And, you know, after that, I had a variety of different jobs, and ultimately sort of fell into a union staff position. It had not been my goal in life,
mm-hmm.
but some people started leaning on me, and I took this job as an organizer in District 65 of the United Auto Workers in Boston. And, you know, I just kept going from there.
Our guest, Bill Fletcher, Jr. today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments, the telephone number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Please call if you'd like to. Bill Fletcher, you know, one of the common perceptions of organized labor, I wouldn't say it's a developed perception, but it's a sort of a street-level perception, that is that it's basically a not connected to progressive politics as organized labor has traditionally been in the United States and almost every other country in the world,
mm-hmm.
but instead has become this domain of privileged white men, that it's a racist entity, probably even more so than other institutions, sort of an uncouth, unvarnished racism toward people of color. This is something you've clearly been wrestling with your entire career.
Right.
What's your sense of that perception, and how has that or has it not changed?
You know, when growing up, my parents were both union members. They instilled in me and my sister this basic notion that unions were important, but that there really were two kinds of unions. And they would always say this. My father would just regularly say there was the unionism of Harry Bridges and the West Coast dock workers, and he'd call that the real unionism. Mm-hmm. Of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And then he'd say there was the racist and corrupt unionism that you found often in the building trades and a number of mobbed-up unions. That notion was very, very important to me because my parents did not look at unions as a panacea. They looked at them as a possibility. And I think that that's very, very, it's critically important. And one of the things that I've found that many younger activists these days don't get, unions are a possibility. They are not at all a panacea. They are a possibility in the sense that they can go any number of directions. And when you think about the labor movement very broadly in the United States, going back into the 19th century, it wasn't just unions, and it wasn't just white unions. You had, in the 19th century, mixed unions, for example, in the Knights of Labor. You had unions that were made up entirely of Chicanos, that is, Mexican-Americans, African-Americans. And in the 20th century, what you saw at certain key moments, like in the 1930s, when the Congress of Industrial Organizations was built, you saw the recognition that this new union movement could not be successful without African-American and Chicano workers. I mean, it was very, very clear when you look at where these movements grew.
Mm-hmm.
So at certain points in the movement, you have unions that were taking extremely good stands on racial matters, like the meatpackers in the packing house workers in the Midwest and on the East Coast, who would not only fight to ensure that workers of color could enter in, but they would fight against discrimination on the job. In fact, they would even fight and challenge employers on their hiring practices. So I think what you see over time is that there's some unions that have been more inclusive, others have not. Some have been very visionary, others have been reactionary. But in the late 1940s, with the Cold War, a dramatic change takes place where progressive and left unionists and unions are driven out of the formal movement, out of the CIO in particular.
I mean, that was the heart of the Red Scare.
That's right. All in the name of going after communists. So basically, anyone that was progressive was liable to be communist. And it was very interesting because one of the things that the FBI was very good at, they would go after white people and they would accuse white people who had black friends. That was usually an indicator, as far as they were concerned, that someone was a communist. I mean, it's really remarkable, Bob.
Yeah.
You know, and so they... So what happens at that point is that there's a tremendous setback, and the officialdom of organized labor, both the AFL and the CIO, and then when they merge, it becomes the AFL-CIO, they basically figured that once they cleaned out the left, that they were on a road towards a permanent partnership with business and with government. And nothing could have been further from the truth. But that laid the foundations for the crisis that we currently find ourselves in. And that's a lot of what our book is about.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, organized labor has really, I mean, just statistically, for sake of listeners, I think many of our older listeners understand this because they've experienced it in their lifetimes. But for younger listeners, organized labor as a percentage of the workforce was significantly higher, say, 1950 than it is today. Do you have some sense of the statistics there, Bill? Oh, I think Bill's going to be reset up with us. I apologize to our listeners.
I'm here.
Oh, you are there.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a sense, Bill, of the drop off in the percentage of the American workforce?
Yeah. It reached a height in 1945 and then later in 1955 of roughly 35% of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point, it was a slow decline until about 1981, and then a steep decline. 1973, then again 1981, very steep decline, so that now it's roughly 12% of the workforce. And part of what is important for your listeners to understand is that this decline does not represent a lack of interest in people joining or forming unions. What it represents are several different factors. One is the growth of the workforce and the inability of the union movement to keep up with that growth for a variety of reasons we'll get to. Second thing is that particularly with the passage of the Taft-Hartley Amendments to the National Labor Relations Act in 1947, union organizing and collective bargaining became extremely difficult. There were a series of draconian measures that were introduced that were described by the Republicans who authored them as leveling the playing field. There was nothing further from the truth. What they did was they weakened the ability of workers to actually organize and fight for their just due.
Yeah.
And so from that point on, it was like a slow simmering to a boil. And so we're now in a very, very critical situation. Now, that said, it's important for people to keep in mind that unions still represent about 16 million people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an insignificant number of people. But, you know, as a percentage of the workforce, it is dwindling.
Bill, what do you think would be, if we had pre-Taft-Hartley labor law still in the United States, what existed, say, between the Wagner Act of 1935 and 1947 with Taft-Hartley, if those were still the laws affecting labor organizing in the United States today, do you think we'd still be at 35-40% of the population being organized?
If you look at the quality and the character of the leadership that has existed in organized labor from, let's just take the period from 55 to 95,
mm-hmm.
I would say that there would have been probably a drop-off of 5 to 10%.
Mm.
So we'd probably be looking at somewhere around 25% of the workforce. That would be my guess. But when you, and the reason is that the leadership of organized labor, particularly under George Meany, did not pay attention to organizing the unorganized.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for George Meany, it really wasn't all that important because he believed, for whatever perverse reason, that organized labor had a permanent seat at the table of power. And therefore, if workers didn't want to join unions, essentially, the heck with them. You know, I mean, that was fine. And this is one of the things that you see in this entire period. But I think if you add on the combination of the laws that were implemented plus economic restructuring, there would have been a drop-off.
Our guest, Bill Fletcher, Jr., you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. This is a live show, as I said, so you can call in with questions or comments for our guests, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Bill Fletcher, as I introduced him at the beginning of the show, longtime labor activist in a number of prominent unions, also the former president and CEO of TransAfrica Forum, currently the co-author of a new book coming out early next year on the history and state of organized labor and progressive politics in the United States today, and also a journalist who writes frequently on the web and for various media about politics, African-American politics, progressive politics in general, and the labor movement. So he is able to answer and discuss a broad range of subjects. Please call in if you have questions or comments. Bill, you mentioned in your last answer that from 1955 to 1995, labor's leadership was of a certain nature that was fairly complacent. I noted the year 1995. Have things changed in the past decade?
In 1995, John Sweeney, who had been the president of the Service Employees International Union, was elected in a reform movement that was unprecedented within the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO, up until that point, had three presidents, George Meany, Lane Kirkland, and then very briefly, when Kirkland stepped down, Tom Donahue, who had been the Secretary of Treasury. Sweeney attempted to introduce a series of reforms in the way that the movement operated, the Federation operated, but he ran into problems, which is a number of a bit of what we also discuss in the book, that Sweeney's style of leadership is guided by how he interprets the notion of consensus. So it is unlike Sweeney, for example, to stake out a position and then try to win people over to it. It's more that he works the crowd, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And what that can often mean is that change is very slow or that it's easily blocked. The other thing about what happened, I mean, someone once asked me in an interview, they said, well, Bill, if you had been the president of the AFL-CIO, elected in 1995, what would you have done differently? And I said, one of the first things I would have done would have been called a special meeting of the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO for some isolated place. So like January 96, probably do it like in Cape Cod, Massachusetts or something like that, you know, off season, and where people weren't going to be disturbed. I'd take like a weekend and bring the leaders together and tell them they could only bring one staff person with them, not a whole entourage, and that the staff people could not talk unless they were asked to talk. And then I would say, all right, now we're going to talk as leaders of the AFL-CIO, and we're going to begin a discussion about what kind of federation we need. And mm-hmm. what is the actual situation workers are facing, and what does it mean that we need to do differently? Now, this ultimately would have evolved into some sort of planning process, but I would have wanted to start with that discussion with the group, an unscripted discussion. That's not the style that Sweeney had.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what happened was that, you know, he would work the crowd, he'd meet with different leaders pretty much one-on-one, but not have these sort of unstructured, unscripted discussions as a whole. So he began a reform process, and then he ran into a whole series of problems, which we detail in the book. But things ground to a halt. And I would suggest that part of why it ground to a halt was, ironically, that he was so worried about a split that he pulled back prematurely from moving certain valuable, and I would argue, essential points of debate. So debate went underground, and there was a lot of frustration that boiled up. So I think that it was a reform movement that had very good points in the beginning. There was a great deal of sincerity, but that they were not really ready to push the envelope in the way that it needed to be pushed. And the thing is, Bob, you know, I mean, there was a split in AFL-CIO in 2005, as you know, and part of what Fernando Gappasin and I argue is that maybe there needed to be a split, but not this split. In other words, the basis upon which the AFL-CIO split was pretty ridiculous. The different sides did not formulate their positions very well, and it hasn't resulted in anything. There are real differences within the union movement, and sometimes there does need to be a parting of the ways. But when you have the parting of the ways, you better be pretty sure that everyone understands what's at stake. And that's not what happened.
Our guest, Bill Fletcher Jr., we're talking about his career, his new book on the state of labor movement and progressive politics in the United States. This is a live show. We have three callers patiently waiting to join us here at WILL AM 580. Let's get back to the phone lines, or to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line one, which is on a cell phone. Line one, you're on the air with Bill Fletcher Jr.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air with Bill Fletcher.
Right. I was calling to find out how our guest would respond to the argument that unions are responsible for causing American auto companies to fall behind the Japanese automakers?
A very good question. And I would start with the movie Tucker. If you haven't seen it, caller, you should see that film, because it details a true story of an initial crisis in the auto industry that had absolutely nothing to do with unions, but it had to do with the myopia, the lack of vision within the auto industry, where and their arrogance, their complete and total arrogance, believing that they were going to be sitting on top of the world forever. And instead of retooling, instead of addressing what the consumers were looking for, they arrogantly continued to produce cars that made absolutely no sense, environmentally as well as consumer-wise. So the issue of the crisis of the auto industry has nothing to do with what the demands of the auto workers. It has to do with the direction that the ownership of the auto industry took the auto industry, and when all of a sudden they were confronted with the magnitude of the Japanese and German and eventually the Korean response, then they took the path that was very slick, and it really was completely manipulative, of blaming the unions for their problems.
Bill, if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, many of the companies that increased their market share against U.S. firms in the U.S. auto industry and globally, these companies in Germany and from Asia were also union shops. These were
absolutely. In interestingly, Bob, in their home countries, like Germany, they were unionized. Now, the 1980s and 90s, particularly in the 90s, you start to see more of these what are called transplants. So Volkswagen and Toyota come to the United States, and they go largely into the South, and they go non-union. So in other words, they come to the United States for cheap labor. Think about that, right? It's not just people going to Central America for cheap labor. They go to the United States for cheap labor. But you're absolutely right. In their home countries, particularly the Germans, you have unionized auto workers. So it's the same thing.
Our guest, Bill Fletcher Jr., let's go back to the phone. Let me remind people we do have lines open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Now let's go to our toll line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Bill Fletcher Jr.
Hello. Thank you for a wonderful program. I was at the forum, Mr. Fletcher, where you were one of the panelists yesterday, the Democracy Forum in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And I know there were serious critiques of both money in politics and problems of corporate media bias. And so both of those areas are encompassed by your discussion. I wonder whether it would strengthen labor as well as others to join in the effort to reduce the amount of influence of corporate money and influence in the political process. I don't know if the split in labor reduces the political power to go after that, but we all agreed it was a problem, and I think that reducing corporate influence, even if it would also reduce the ability of labor to contribute money to political candidates and so forth, it would be overwhelmed by the freedom that we gather from getting corporations out of the business of buying people and votes.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question. It's not just in the political realm. I mean, In the media realm, which Bob can talk about much more than me, the influence of corporate money is absolutely it's absolutely phenomenal. And so what we have is a situation where, you're right, the unions need to be engaged in a struggle to democratize, that's the way I would look at it, democratizing the electoral realm. And that means getting the money out, public funding of campaigns. I think you're absolutely right. And unfortunately, and there's actually an analogy here with the inability of the union movement in the early 90s to unite around healthcare reform, too many unions think in terms of how they can make an intervention in the electoral realm by raising money rather than thinking longer term about we've got to get money out of this. There's got to be a way for regular people to engage in the electoral realm and not have as the first item on the front of a newspaper how much money have Barack and Hillary gotten.
You know, Bill, before we go back to the phone lines, we've got several callers waiting patiently. I want to follow up on this and ask you about the relationship of organized labor to the Democratic Party and likewise the African-American community, because these are the two constituencies that are the bedrock of support for the Democratic candidates in this country across the board. And in the case of labor, bedrock of financial support for the party. You know, this is a relationship I know you've thought about a lot and talked about and written about at times. I mean, what is the nature of how good of a relationship is this for organized labor, for example?
Well, the relationship between organized labor and the Democratic Party actually goes back to the 19th century and the period immediately after the Civil War, what in the South was known as Reconstruction. And evolved over time, and particularly with the advent of the Roosevelt administration, it took a very specific turn. The problem of the relationship of the, in my view, of the relationship of organized labor to the Democratic Party today is that it is largely uncritical, but second, that there is a failure on the part of the unions to develop a sufficiently independent program and organization such that they can actually influence developments within the Democratic Party. Let me explain what I mean by that. I'm not just talking about endorsing candidate A versus candidate B. I'm talking about the whole notion of actually developing, identifying working class candidates, union members, and our allies who represent the interests of working people, getting them organized, getting them prepared, getting them funded, given the situation and the way that laws are now, and elected, but building an accountability mechanism. I mean, in the Democratic Party, when you have groups like the Blue Dogs, the Democratic Leadership Council, etc., you have to have another force that represents the views of working people. And organized labor has simply not done that. It has been a force that the Democratic politicians have very often been willing to go and get money from and then turn their faces away from. And so part of what we need to do is absolutely introduce a new type of politics. This is one of the things I wrote about, as you know, a couple of years ago in this article in The Nation with Danny Glover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it got a lot of attention on the new rainbow movement.
That's right. It was called Visualizing a Neo-Rainbow, and the idea was that because of the undemocratic nature of the U.S. electoral system, it's very difficult here, more difficult than in most countries, to set up alternative parties, alternative electoral parties. And therefore, it's useful to start thinking about building an organization that is independent but can run people within the primaries of existing parties, just as the nonpartisan leagues did in the Midwest and the Rainbow Coalition was doing in the 1980s. That's a direction that labor should be thinking. Instead, it relegates its role to funding candidates and, you know, endorsements, get the vote, but that's about it.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We have a few callers waiting patiently to speak with our guest, Bill Fletcher Jr., longtime veteran activist in the labor movement with TransAfrica Forum, writing, fighting for the interests of people of color, not just in the United States, but throughout the Americas and in Africa, and now presently the co-author of a new book on the subject we've been talking about tonight, today, the labor movement in American politics. The book won't be out till next year. We'll let you know when it does come out. But let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, another cell phone. You're on the air with Bill Fletcher, Jr. Hello, line 3.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Fletcher.
Yes.
I have two items I would like to discuss, if I may. The first one, you had mentioned earlier in the program that the height of the unionized workforce was, I believe, 35%. And then lately, maybe in 85, it was a lower rate. Are you able to quote what the actual numbers are at that time when it was highly unionized and the most recent percentage?
The absolute numbers right now remain, and this is one of the oddities, it's remained pretty stable in the 16 million plus number. The percentage is the thing that has dropped dramatically.
I understand.
Yeah.
Now, it's in the 16 million range.
Right.
Would that include federal employees?
Yes, it includes. I'm talking about everybody, not just the AFL-CIO. I'm talking about people that are in the AFL-CIO, the Change to Win, as well as independent unions.
Right, okay. My second question is, could you comment on what effect, if any, occurred as a result of the unions having to no longer have a closed election? Has that caused the union workforce to drop?
Not having a closed election?
In other words, a vote. That the vote, that they, the, as I understand it, the vote is now open, whereas before it was secret?
No.
The vote to have a union, if you want to organize a factory, Bill, or a workplace, is the how has it changed? Is it... is it an open vote or is it a secret vote? How is that?
No, there's different ways of achieving union recognition in an unorganized situation. So one way is what's called card check. And basically, the idea is that the people sign up to join a union. You go to management and say, we have more than half of the workforce that wants a union. Will you voluntarily recognize us? And the manager or the owner can say, sure, I'll recognize you, and we'll start bargaining. The manager may not do that, in which case you will be either forced to have an election or the union may try to pressure the manager to eventually accede to card check. If there is an election under the National Labor Relations Board, it is a secret ballot election. The problem, though, which many people don't get because of the manipulation of the media on this one.
Yeah, a point I want to get to after this answer.
Yeah, while the election may be secret, management can intimidate you in the lead-up to the election. It would be as if you're having a school board election or election for mayor in your city, and one side could grab all the voters when they are in a public space and stop those voters from going anywhere and basically imply to them that if they don't vote the right way, the city will collapse. Essentially, that's what employers can do. And the ramifications when they even commit a breaking of the law is so minimal that employers often break the law because they can pay a price, but it's so minimal because they keep the workforce disorganized. So the actual election, if there isn't an NLRB election, National Labor Relations Board, it is a secret ballot election.
Bill, just talk a little bit before we go back to the phone lines about media coverage of labor, of the labor movement, of organizing campaigns, but of labor in general. And let me just preface this by saying I've recently seen some research, and it corresponds to my own memory on this point, that during the 1960s and 1950s, there was a great deal more coverage of labor in our news media. It was actually an area that people knew about, just who were average citizens in the country, which does not really seem to be the case to me in recent decades.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, it's been dropping significantly. There used to be people called, labor reporters and the labor desk in many of the major newspapers, and those positions have all but vanished. Labor stories now are largely carried in the business section of the paper and very often by people who know about as much about unions as I do about Venus and perhaps even less. And so they'll write very biased and sometimes actually very stupid commentaries and analyses that evidence no understanding of what's actually going on in the movement. But the other piece to this is not just the lack of coverage, but the type of coverage. So you have terms that are thrown around like labor boss. Now, I mean, that term, what does that mean, a labor boss?
It's like a mob boss or something.
Exactly. I mean, you start thinking about Gambino or something. You know what I mean? A labor boss. But that term is very... unconscious. It's not like that was just something that, you know, someone popped into someone's head one day. The term is extremely derogatory and aims to try to lead the listener or the viewer to believe that the union is essentially an extension of the mob. Additionally, you'll have a lack of coverage of real issues. I mean, in the period that led up to the split in AFL-CIO, one of the amazing things was the total lack of sophistication on the part of the commentators in the mainstream media. I mean, I would read some of these things, and they reduced their analysis to John Sweeney, this old man with old ideas, versus Andy Stern, this young man who is innovative and visionary. Mm-hmm. Not looking at any of the things that really are at stake or what each side was actually advocating.
They just personalized the whole thing.
Very, very, very much so.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now, Bill Fletcher Jr., because we have a couple people waiting very patiently to speak with you. Let's go now to line 2, Champagne. You're on the air with Bill Fletcher Jr.
Hi, I think this is my turn.
Yes, it is. Thank you for your patience. I think you win my all-time patience award.
I just wanted to give a little piece of information, because I do go to the AFL-CIO central body, and I know one thing that you mentioned was the building trades and their position and, you know, the problems that minority recruitment there. And I know that right now that the building trades are, recruiting apprenticeship programs, and they're very interested in minority recruitment. Also that they have trouble with that because, of course, if you don't have a lot of people of color in your ranks, then it's harder for you to be seen as open. So I just want to give that piece of information. Also on campus, AFL-CIO, unions that are active are AFSCME and SEIU, and they are both in contract negotiations right now against the university. And I kind of like your speaker's comments on those two unions as being more interested in recruiting members from underrepresented groups and going out and being more aggressive towards membership towards some of the other groups. And also, I kind of like your guest's comments on a group that's been very important to labor people in this town that is fairly new to us, which is the Jobs for Justice group, which is giving a lot of support to all the labor unions and all the labor movements in this particular town. So I'm interested in what he has to say about AFSCME, SEIU, and Jobs for Justice as kind of different perspectives and something maybe a little bit more up-to-date here.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Bill Fletcher, Jr., how do you respond?
Well, there's a lot there. So let me just start first, actually, with the building trades. Your caller is right that there's a number of building trades that in the recent past have been carrying out outreach to various peoples of color. That said, the craft nature of the building trades has tended to mean that they have restricted how many people can get in order to try to guarantee a higher wage for those who are in. That is the underlying philosophical basis. And that then dovetails with the issue of race in the United States and the way that people of color, and particularly African Americans, have been kept out of various labor markets. Thus, in the late 19th century, in the South, the building trades were actually dominated, workforce-wise, by black workers. But white unionists came in and drove them out. There was an ethnic cleansing of the building trades and the railroads. So that was the context in which I made my earlier comment. SEIU and AFSCME have done overall a much better job in terms of seeking out to organize workers irrespective of, you know, the race, nationality, gender, etc. And I think that work needs to be applauded. I just think it needs to go further than it is. And with regard to Jobs for Justice, very, very important organization formed in 1987, which is essentially a coalition of unions, some community organizations, but it really is an organization for working people who want to get involved in workers' rights. And I have just so many good things to say about Jobs for Justice. I've spoken at Jobs for Justice events and very, very supportive of their work. And I think that they are the type of formation that we need if labor is going to survive as a social movement.
Bill Fletcher, Jr., before we get back to the phone lines and continue this discussion, which I suspect will continue along the lines of talking about the future of organized labor, its problems, its possibilities, and its relationship to progressive politics, I want to turn to a related issue, but something else you've written on and you've been talking about, which is the Gen of Six.
Yeah.
And maybe for some of our listeners, and we go globally now thanks to podcasting as well as being primarily in East Central Illinois, you could just give a little background on the Gen of Six case, but then talk about, you know, your take on it, what the potential could come of this.
Well, the case involves six black young men, teenagers, basically, in Jenna, Louisiana. And Jenna, Louisiana is a very small town, majority white. And make a long story short, at the high school, there were a series of racist actions against African Americans, including the hanging of a noose at a tree under which white boys usually sat, and a black teenager wanted to sit there and was permitted to by the university, high school, but then a noose was set up there in order to intimidate him. There was a fight at a party. There was a shotgun that was brandished against some of these black youth, and then there was a fight in which a white youth was beaten. As a result of the fight, there were charges that were brought against these six black teenagers, and they were charged not as youth, but as adults. And they were, in one case, incarcerated for 10 months because the family could not afford the bail. There was such anger that was seething within black America that a demonstration was set for September for Gen of Six, and it was a national mobilization. And I don't know the final count in terms of the numbers of people that showed up, but I've heard, you know, 50,000. I mean, huge numbers of people showed up, and it was a mobilization that, in some ways, much like the immigrant mobilization of May 2006, mm-hmm. that was assisted by radio commentators. So black radio stations, particularly, the Tom Joyner Show, really promoted this mobilization. And so people turned out. It did not change the decision. Well, let me back up. The one case was vacated. A decision was vacated. But the young man in question ended up back in jail for an unrelated charge by the same judge that had originally incarcerated him. I think that this case is very interesting in many ways, not the least of which is the distinction in the response by many whites compared to black Americans. So many whites have said, well, you know, these kids did attack this white guy, and he was badly beaten, although he wasn't badly beaten enough that he couldn't go to a party that night, and therefore action needed to be taken, and, you know, school violence needs to be stopped. And what's missed in this is what's called disparate treatment. You know, in other words, the hanging of the noose, the brandishing of a shotgun, all of this was treated, when it was done by white youth, as if it was sort of boys will be boys. But then when there's this fight, a schoolyard fight, essentially, then that's treated not simply as violence, but adult violence. And so, again, the experience of the African-American is dismissed, except in insofar as the African-American is treated as the perpetual villain.
Bill, we hardly have any time left. Can I just... We have a couple callers, and I'd want to go on with this, but we really ought to get to this one caller in particular from Line
sure.
1 Champagne. Line 1 Champagne, who our most patient caller ever, thank you for waiting. You're on there now with Bill Fletcher, Jr.
Yeah, I'll make this comment first and then a question. The comment is that you talked about the auto industry. If it wasn't for the Japanese coming in with the products, we'd still be living with the same technology that they had in the 50s. You know, they actually pushed them. The question is in terms of the unions, what has been the impact of free trade, which I think is really a joke, is free trade for the American corporations and not fair trade for the countries they deal with? So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Oh, it's a great question, caller. And the impact has been devastating for certain sections of the economy, as you know. So, for example, in garment and textile, we basically don't have garment and textile to speak of in the United States anymore. I mean, it's concentrated in a few places, but it's been seriously, seriously weakened by a combination of technology as well as free trade. The ability of countries to dump products on the market has absolutely affected workers here. But I think it's important to understand that free trade as a global phenomenon has really undermined the living standards of workers internationally. I was just reading this article in Dollars and Cents magazine about Mexico, and believe it or not, Mexico is facing tremendous job loss where jobs are now going to China. So this whole free trade mania has not worked to develop the situation of the living standard of working people. It has ended up being a club over our heads. So it's gotten to the point that even if your company cannot move, as one of my mentors, the late Bennett Harrison, would say, there's a credible threat that they will move. And that fear has many workers paralyzed.
Bill Fletcher, we're just about to wrap up. We've only got about a minute left on the show. You know, as you look forward, I mean, you've been around a while. In a nutshell, I mean, are you optimistic going forward the next 5-10 years in this country, or are you fear we're heading into rougher times?
Both. Both.
Good
answer. I think we're headed into rougher times, but I'm terribly optimistic. And the reason is that, in some ways, there's really no room for pessimism. I mean, we are confronted not only with the environmental disasters, but economic disasters. And in the face of that, I expect a very intense resistance. What's missing, though, is a level of organization and a clearer strategy. And we're hoping that our book, at least with regard to the labor movement, is a modest contribution towards that discussion.
On that note, Bill Fletcher, Jr., thank you for joining me. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you all for listening to Media Matters. Thank John Anderson for producing, Brett Paulson for working the board. Back in 1 week with Katrina Vandenhoevel. Have a great week, everyone.